Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're coming to you from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the event that's happening tonight called Burritos to Biofuels. I'm very happy now to welcome John Turk. He is a scientist, he's an adventurer, and he's author of the new book, The Raven's Gift, A Scientist, a Shaman, and Their Remarkable Journey Through the Siberian Wilderness. And he will be at the Bryce Gallery in Taos tomorrow evening, February 23rd, at 7 in the evening. That's in a collaboration with Moby Dickens Bookstore. And he will be here in Santa Fe at Garcia Street Books this coming Thursday at 5 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, John.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you start out the book talking about the two sides of your life, the laboratory scientist. You have a PhD in chemistry, you've written a lot of textbooks in science, and then the outdoorsman. And it's in the outdoors that you have always really found that personal and kind of spiritual fulfillment, and you've put yourself certainly in way more risky situations than more of the rest of us have. How did you find yourself paddling across the North Pacific Ocean and ending up in Siberia?
Well, that's the end of a long sequence of events. I got my PhD in 1971, that's 40 years ago, but there was a call in me that I really didn't want to spend the rest of my life in the basement of the mass spectrometry laboratory downstairs, bolted to bedrock in an artificial environment under fluorescent lights, and I started adventuring, and the adventuring over a period of 30 to 40 years got more and more intense. So I became an expedition sea kayaker, and I sea kayaked in the Arctic and around Cape Horn, which is considered one of the most tempestuous pieces of ocean in the world. But when I turned around 50, I decided I wanted to paddle a production kayak across an ocean. And as long as I was at it, I thought I'd choose the Pacific as a start.
So you ended up in a place that I'd never heard of, but it's a part of Siberia that was once a totally indigenous cultural world unto itself and was all but wiped out by the Soviet Union. And there you met a very old woman shaman. How did you find her? What happened?
Well, I think she found me, Mary Charlotte. We were paddling along the coast, and a sudden storm came up just as we passed this small village of Ivenka. So we came into the village to seek shelter, and this woman was standing on the beach, and she said, "Welcome, we were expecting you. The grandmother made a storm to bring you to the village because she wanted to talk to you." And, you know, my first reaction was, this was so incomprehensible that I didn't want to think about it or relate to it. And in my second book, In the Wake of the Jomon, where I described the incident, I left that part out because this concept of being summoned by the old woman was so foreign to my worldview that I wasn't ready to accept it. But now I am a lot more ready to accept it, and the answer is, Mulanat wanted to talk to me, she found me, I didn't find her.
So what happened next? You met her. What was the interaction like?
The interaction was very simple. We had lunch together. She was cleaning fish. It was fishing season. One rule I learned among the Koryak women is that during fishing season, you don't talk to them. They're fishing. And she was very busy. We had a very simple lunch. We passed a few simple words back and forth. And then she came up to me and she grasped me by the elbow. She stands under 5 feet tall. She's, you know, maybe 4'10". She's 100 years old. She's wrinkled. She grasped me by the elbow. She stared into my eyes and said, "Come back. It will be good for you if you do." And we left when the storm broke. We paddled onward towards Alaska. And then I talked to my Russian friend, Misha. I said, "You know, I think we have to come back." And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, we do." So that was the beginning of the story.
It was on that first visit that you found, I think of the first visit, that you found out about something called the Holy Stone.
Yes. And the Holy Stone, I think, is very critical. I'm glad you brought this up, Mary Charlotte. It's very critical to the Koryak worldview, and I think the view of shamanic societies and ancient wisdoms throughout the world. According to this worldview, there's energy within the earth, and this energy rises through the earth and can be transferred to people. But then, in order to keep the energy flowing, the people have to bring the energy back to the earth. So there's a cycle of energy from earth to people to earth to people. And if that cycle is broken, then it's broken. And it can only be maintained by reverence for the planet. So on every journey that we went to consecrate the journey, to give us strength for the journey, we go to the Holy Stone first. And the obvious metaphor for modern technological people is that when we break our exchange with the earth, we can't just take from the earth, we have to take and give.
This is a theme in so many different indigenous cultures, and it does make one think that a lot of people before us understood way more about the environmental chain of being and the web of interconnectedness than we ever thought possible.
Well, you say this perfectly, and that's my mission now with the book and with my journey. I'm on a long book tour journey, and it's my mission to be one voice. There are many voices out there. There are many very spiritually aligned people out there, and I'm hoping to be one of them and to preach and to say that we have to be connected to the earth, that if we just keep taking and crunching and munching and driving bulldozers and knocking down forests and digging up prairies and whatnot, it won't work. It's not sustainable. And there has to be a spiritual connection to the planet and an exchange for us to be sustainable on this planet.
I want to get back to your story, but before we do, there's another story in the book along the lines of what you're talking about that I found fascinating, which was the story of how the Koryak people who were there in the place that you were visiting, who herded reindeer, fostered a harmony between the reindeer and the wolves. Tell us that.
Yeah. In the old days before the Soviets came, of course there were reindeer, of course there were wolves. And according to the legends and the stories that I've heard, the herders would make a pact with the wolves, and they would let the wolves take some deer, and in return the wolves would respect the people's wish to survive in this very harsh land. So the wolves would survive, the wolves would get something to eat, the people would survive, and the reindeer would survive, and everything worked in harmony. Now, when the Russians came and the Soviets after the Bolshevik Revolution, the Soviets said, well, the wolves are eating some deer, and we want to maximize production. So they brought in strychnine, guns, traps, and even helicopters. They flew over in helicopters and shot wolves from the air. And when they brought in all this technology, the predation by wolves increased over the ancient pact, which was based on trust, on a spiritual communication between the wolves and the people.
One of the reasons I ask you this is because there are resonances of this in New Mexico, where we have the reintroduction of wolves, and a lot of people happy about it, and a lot of ranchers very, very unhappy about it. And the same dynamic is going on exactly here, as it is in a lot of places in the U.S.
Yeah, and it's going on in Montana, where I live. Not too long ago, I walked out behind my house, and a wolf came down and sat down. And I sat down in front of the wolf, and we just sat and stared at each other for a while and trying to build that harmony.
We're talking to John Turk. His book is called The Raven's Gift. Now, you went back to this to this place, to this village with the very old shaman woman. She said it would be good for you to go back. You went back without a goal in mind, but at a certain point you realized that you wanted to ask her to help you heal an old injury, which was a really bad injury and which was causing you what seems like, although you were quite stoic about it, a pretty excruciating amount of pain.
Yeah, and I didn't really have much choice about it. I wanted to go to Siberia ostensibly to thank Moulinat, to meet her, and to shoot a film about reindeer herding people. And while we were out on the tundra shooting this film, I was muscling a snow machine out of a creek. We had dropped it through the ice, and I landed on my pelvis. I slipped, fell, landed on my pelvis, and I couldn't walk. So here I was in a very, very remote place in Siberia, lying in the snow, unable to walk, and my traveling companion seemed totally unconcerned. This was not something to worry about because they would tie me on a sled and bring me back to the village, and the old lady would heal me.
Now this was, I mean, you had had an injury in your pelvis that was sustained during an avalanche where basically your pelvis was split apart and through surgery they put a metal plate in, screwed it together, and now the metal plate, the screws had come apart. This is serious business.
Yeah, it's serious business, and it's physics too. You have, as you just described, you have metal, you have screws, you have bone. So my first reaction, I understand that shamans and healers in the Amazon and in the jungle have medicinal herbs that have great pharmacological potency, and I can understand how people heal diseases, diabetes, and illnesses of various kinds with drugs. But here we had a serious orthopedic problem, and this woman said that she could heal me. Basically what she did, the healing process, was to ask me to stand on one leg, put one arm behind my back, put the other arm out in front of me. I was naked. And she journeyed to the other world to talk to Kutha, the raven god, and ask him to intervene on my behalf, which at that time was something quite outside of my normal realm of experience.
And it also involved trance-inducing mushrooms, is that correct?
Yeah, well, the healing was done without mushrooms. The healing she wanted to transpose me totally without any, there was no pharmacological substances of any kind during the healing process. And then afterwards, when I wanted to thank Kutka, the raven god, then we used hallucinogenic mushrooms to go into the other world and to thank Kutka. And I never completed it in the other world. The journey I couldn't complete in the other world. Olek, the hunter, my companion on the land, said, John, you're a lousy traveler in the other world, but you can make your journey in this world. And that's really the story of the book, is being faced with this journey that I now had to take, and I had to take it in the real world on the tundra.
The long and short of it is that you were healed, and that's the amazing thing. And part of how that healing occurred, besides what you've just said, was that this shaman required you or asked you to believe in what she was doing, which wasn't easy. How did you shut off your science mind and allow yourself to believe in something that seemed so just far out?
Well, I don't really know the answer to that question, Mary Charlotte, and I still don't know the answer. I find the healing to be just one aspect, almost like a hook, to draw me into a much broader world view than I had been previously willing to accept. And as a scientist, you're taught to live in your left brain world, in a world of narrow logic. And what Moulinat was asking me to do was to open up my whole being into a different world. And I think that the healing was just sort of an added Benny to that. And the real journey and the real strength was to feel a connectivity to the earth.
Very interesting. There, every time, everything that you say, and in your book, I felt this too, connects to so many different spiritual traditions. It's not what happened there is also repeated in other traditions of shamanism and their connections to Buddhism and things like that as well. And all of them basically require you to not reject science, but just suspend that scientific part of you for at least part of your life experience.
Yeah, think of it this way, Mary Charlotte. For 99.7% of our tenure on Earth as human beings, we lived in a very mixed world where we were dealing with logic on one hand, but also very heavily based in a broader connectivity with the world around us. A scientist is looking for a logical sequence. A hunter is open to the whole world around to understand the changes, the flow of the cycle of the seasons and the day and so on and so forth. And the modern person, you and me, spends 85% of our thought process in the left brain, in the logic-oriented side. And Moulinat was asking me to shift that over. And in shifting that over, in shifting to opening up to everything around us, what happens is that you become connected to the earth. You feel that you are not this individual taking from this earth, but part of this circle of flow, the circle of flow that has been part of our humanity for 2 million years. So she was just asking me to step back a little bit to go to where our ancestors were before the Industrial Revolution.
We're talking to John Turk. His book is called The Raven's Gift, A Scientist, A Shaman, and Their Remarkable Journey Through the Siberian Wilderness. Now, this is also a story not only of your experience, but of cultural loss, which we've kind of been talking about, what the Soviets, and particularly Stalin, did to the native people there, which I have to say sounds remarkably similar to what this country did to the native people here, including the boarding schools and the concrete housing and the killing of the languages and the traditions and the whole thing.
Yeah, and I would extend what you say is absolutely true. I agree with you 100%, but I would extend it. It's also what's been done to the corporate government, not to sound too paranoid here, but also this whole corporate entity is stripping us, all of us, from our humanity. Just as it stripped Moulinat, it stripped the Native Americans in New Mexico and the rest of North America. So the life of Moulinat, where she grew up on the tundra and then was stripped of her spirituality, or they attempted to strip her of it, is the same thing that's happening to you and me. And we have to realize that we're not just trying to protect and defend other people. We're trying to protect and defend ourselves.
It's a very interesting thing because it seems that it's a wonderful time, and you, through your work and through your life, are embodying this, a wonderful time for a spirituality of the land and a scientific approach to ecosystems, for those to really come together.
I think it's time to do this. I think we're at a critical junction. We can't have peace on the earth until we have peace with the earth. And I think that we're at a critical junction here where technology is so powerful that we are in danger of taking ourselves in a direction where our existence on this planet is not sustainable. And I don't want to sound too melodramatic or catastrophic, but I think we're at a junction where we have to turn now and slow down this rush towards consumerism and technology and destruction of resources, and slow down a little bit and, you know, smell the flowers. It's pretty simple.
You promised at a certain point to write about the people you met, and you've done so. Why did they ask you for this promise?
Well, you know, I think about this a lot, because I've talked to writers who have gone to speak to people, and they want their spirituality to be not spread around. They want it to be held in some way secret. But the Koryak people, and Mulinat especially, but not only Mulinat, some of the people we met on the tundra, I think they have this impending sense that their plight and our plight and the world's plight is the same. This one man, Alexei, told me, he started telling me about magic and magic mountains, and I said, why are you telling me this? And he said, because you walked here. And because you walked here, you will understand. And we're asking you to take this back to your world because they need to understand too. So I don't want to set myself up as too much of a John Lennon walking in the white suit across Abbey Road or anything, but I do feel that there's a necessity for messengers out here in our world to tell us what I just said, to slow down and make peace with the earth.
You were also told very strongly to listen to the land, and this leads to a tragic story, a story of an avalanche, in which you were listening to the land, but you kept your mouth closed with very tragic results.
Yeah, my wife died in an avalanche on Mount Tom in the Eastern Sierras near Bishop, California. And the details of her death are very confusing to me because, well, she was writing a book on avalanche safety at the time. And after her death, I went back and I read what she was writing. I opened her computer up, of course, and read what she was writing. And on that day, she broke several of the rules that she had put as rules you cannot ever violate. So there was a question of why this happened and why she stopped listening, but it was a tragedy. I don't know why it happened, but I do know that when it did happen, I needed to go back to Siberia to be healed from my own grief.
And what happened when you went?
Well, Mulinat and Lydia and all my Koryak friends, there were so many wisdoms there from so many views. There is the wisdom of Mulinat, the spiritual healer, and also the wisdom of Alek, the hunter, whose message came from a very different angle, but came to exactly the same point. And it's the lesson that the Buddhists teach us, that Lao Tzu teaches us, that change is inevitable. And we live within a world of change. Change sometimes brings what is on the surface called tragedy, but that what you have, there's in the deepest tragedy, you still have that connection to the earth. That connection to the earth never leaves. So in this case, I lost my wife, who was very, very dear, and it was a huge thing, but I don't lose myself because I'm still connected. I'm not entirely afloat. I still am married with a stronger marriage even to the earth.
We're talking to John Turk. His book is called The Raven's Gift, A Scientist, A Shaman, and Their Remarkable Journey Through the Siberian Wilderness. And he will be in Santa Fe this coming Thursday, the 25th of February, at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. And tomorrow night, Tuesday, the 23rd of February, he'll be at the Bryce Gallery in Taos at 7 o'clock. And that's in collaboration with Moby Dickens Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And we look forward to meeting you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It was a great interview.
I'm very happy now to welcome Randy Grissom. He's the director of the Sustainable Technology Center at the Santa Fe Community College, and James Bingham, who is an instructor there. And they are going to be speaking tonight as part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, doing a presentation called Burritos to Biofuels. And that is tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Morning, Mary Charlotte.
So, burritos to biofuels. Burritos, huh? I thought this was about algae.
Well, we thought we'd take a little leave of language and do a little something that would be catchy. Our program is based upon all sorts of biofuels and all different feedstocks. And so one of the feedstocks is taking waste grease from local restaurants and converting it into biofuels. In addition to that, we are looking at algae and other feedstock.
There are, I met somebody once who was in who basically had converted a van years and years ago to run on grease from kitchens, and they just basically went all through the United States and South America stopping at restaurants and getting their grease and becoming sort of a spectacle along the way. But that's become an accepted and fairly well-known biofuel.
Correct. In fact, we had a great experience a couple of weeks ago. James could share with a couple from Canada that was doing the same thing.
Yeah, we had a couple from Canada that were doing an attempt at breaking the Guinness World Record of the longest miles traveled without stopping at a regular petroleum-based filling station. And they were up to like 25,000 miles, and they'd made it out here to the Wild Wild West. And somehow got hold of Charles, who's my co-teacher, and myself, and they're looking for fuel. Well, we happen to have 40 gallons of biodiesel and 100 gallons of vegetable oil sitting in our lab getting processed. So we came by and we tanked them up and we gave them 1,200 miles worth of distance to go down the road. The next time we heard from them, they were in L.A. and had not had to stop for fuel until then.
Now, one of the fuels that we'll talk about in a moment is algae, which is a very interesting potential and real biofuel. But let's talk about what the range of biofuels is at this point in history and technology. I mean, everybody's heard of ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. I mean, it's interesting to know that the first Ford cars produced by Henry Ford ran on ethanol.
Is that right?
Right. So we didn't have the gasoline products and the petroleum products that we use today. Back in those days. So we're really going back to looking at fuels that we had before and we just quit using for lots of reasons.
Now, how is ethanol made?
Ethanol is just basically a distilled product. The ethanol that we put in our cars is no more fancy than the ethanol that you used to use that moonshine. You know, corn squeezings, corn mash, anything that comes from a vegetable-based cellulosic material that we can ferment with yeasts and sugar. And the yeast eats the sugar that comes out of the mash, creates the alcohol, and that becomes distilled out as the ethanol.
So that's one biofuel. Mm-hmm. Is it always made from corn?
No, you can use a bunch of different varieties of things, whatever. And that's the cool thing about the research is they are beginning to develop more and more products that will break down the enzymes in other plant material that will allow us to get the starches and the sugars out of plant-based material. Corn is probably the most relevantly known and most frequently used just because of its notoriety in the days past from the moonshiners.
Right, right. And corn takes up, or whatever plant you're using, takes up quite a bit of land. And as people look to the future, they look to the increasing population on the planet, there is a question of whether, if we convert to biofuels, whether we are then taking away land that would otherwise be used for food.
Correct. I think one of the things we're very interested in the program at the community college is looking at other feedstock that's not going to come from food or replace food sources. So we're very interested in looking at things that can grow in arid soil and things that can grow in wastewater, briny water, things that can grow in the desert where you can't really grow vegetables.
Have you looked at kudzu?
Well, kudzu hasn't been looked at that I know of, but buffalo gourd, which is a weed here in New Mexico, is highly a potential crop. Now, you know, growing a weed as a crop is different than letting it grow as a weed.
Right.
But the tuber is very rich in starches.
Very interesting. Tell us more about types of plants that could be used for biofuels that really would be farmed, so to speak, on land that couldn't be used for anything else.
Well, one of the big ones right now is camelina. A lot of research has been done in that area. Switchgrass is another potential one. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, algae, which can be grown anywhere that you've got a water source, which doesn't have to be, you know, really good potable water necessarily.
Well, let's talk about that, because you have, I was reading one of your presentations about algae, and it does seem potentially a very rich source of biofuels using not a whole lot of space.
Correct. You can grow algae in open ponds. You can grow it in closed-loop bioreactors that can either be vertical or horizontal.
So like the equivalent of a silo full of algae?
Correct, except it's like a clear silo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a whole variety there. And basically what you're doing is short-circuiting millions of years of evolution that produced the oil in the earth anyway. You're growing it. The algae actually sequesters carbon. It uses carbon as a fertilizer. And so it has lots of variety of uses there.
And how do you measure the productivity and the comparative productivity of various types of biofuels?
The algae, we generally measure it out in gallons per acre, because it's considered, the majority of what we do is open ponds. So we've got a big flat piece of real estate that's got a pond in it, so we've got X number of square feet and X number of millions of algae molecules growing within the water that we harvest. So it's a matter of a ratio of a cell count, basic math, basic science, cell counts on a slide, and guesstimating the amounts of growth per slide, and then calculating that out, extrapolating that out to how many gallons per acre we think is there. The other neat thing is that we've discovered that there's hundreds of thousands of different strains of algae, and many of them are good for the pharmaceutical world, and then we're finding a whole bunch of them that are much more oil producing, and they're going to be very specifically used for our oil production. So we do have a differentiation in what are you going to actually grow your algae for.
So in theory, you can have an algae that eventually is jet fuel.
Exactly. Yeah, the folks down in Las Cruces, Sapphire, they are doing that exact same thing. They are creating what they call biojet, and they've run some experiments in their turbine engines with a highly processed algae oil as a fuel.
This seems like a great potential for reducing dependence on foreign oil, which is a cliche that everybody is always talking about. What kind of production would you have to start matching or, you know, making a real dent on reducing the oil supply that we're now either importing or drilling for?
Well, I think there's a lot of work going on in those areas. There's still a lot of R&D work going on to find the right strains of algae. My personal opinion is that it's part of the mix. I know in New Mexico we're taking a leadership role in exploring some of those things. If nothing else, one of the big opportunities is to replace jet fuel for the military. They consume a lot here in New Mexico, so that's a potential market. A lot of people could almost grow their own for their own transportation vehicles or their own heating capabilities, or even running generators.
When you think about algae, for example, or any biofuel, they sequester carbon, and then when they're burned, then they produce CO2 again. Is it a carbon neutral process ultimately?
It's carbon neutral because we're taking a plant, the algae, which has absorbed CO2 out of the air, and we're burning it in an engine as a fuel source, and that produces CO2 back into the air, but it's a closed loop. We're not taking in the sequestered CO2 that's been buried in the fossil fuels for millions of years and adding that additional CO2 back into the air. So the algae to CO2 in the atmosphere is a much more defined closed loop.
It's a closed loop, but presumably maybe the containers that you're making have to be shipped in from somewhere using... I mean, are there other parts of the production cycle that actually produce more
carbon producing?
Carbon,
transportation costs. But the unique thing about the algae is that, especially out here in the wild, wild west, because the algae is a carbon sequestering plant, we're looking at putting big algae farms next to coal-fired power plants so that the distance the CO2 has to travel is minimal. We don't have to actually physically sequester the CO2 from the stacks at the factory and ship it to the algae farms. It just happens naturally through the airflow.
Very interesting.
So it eliminates that. And I think we will always have, to some degree, some kind of an impact. What we'll try to do is minimize it of some kind of CO2 output in transportation and manufacturing. We are continually striving to find the most economical and environmental ways to achieve fuel.
And can I add to that, too? One of the goals of the biofuels industry right now is to try to make use of the existing infrastructure if possible. So use the same pipelines that are currently used to push oil around, use it to push biofuels around. Use the same trucking system, so not having to replicate anything at the present time. We think acceptance would come quicker that way, too.
Do they burn clean or the same amount of clean as petroleum fuels?
Biodiesel itself runs wonderfully cleaner than petroleum diesel in all aspects. Up until recently, they thought that the NOx emissions from biodiesel was higher, but they've gone back and they've done retesting with much more sensitive equipment, and they're discovering that the NOx emissions are no worse than petroleum diesel.
The what emissions?
NOx, the NOx, the stuff that makes the smog in the valleys, nitrous oxide. That's the particulate emission that makes smog, and that's the visible one that's the most infamous of the pollutants that are out there. And they're discovering now that as biodiesel refineries get more and more proficient at what they're making, a higher quality product, that their emissions even in that area are dropping off to standards that are either on par with petroleum or diesel or surpassing it. And everything else, all the other particulates in biodiesel are way below what comes out of the tailpipe from petroleum diesel. The other really wonderful fact about biodiesel is that now that the EPA has mandated that we have this ultra-low sulfur diesel stuff, well, sulfur used to be the lubricant in petroleum diesel. Well, the trucking industry is just beside itself because all their engines are beginning to seize up because they've lost their lubrication. If we can go back and put as little as a 5% biodiesel solution into their petroleum, we've reintroduced the lubricity that the ultra-low sulfur stuff removed.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so there's many, many elements of biodiesel that are going to fit into the existing infrastructure and with the existing truck traffic that's out there.
We're talking to Randy Grissom and James Bingham from the Sustainable Technology Center at Santa Fe Community College. They will be talking tonight at 6 o'clock. We'll give more information about that at the end of the show today. Now, for example, using algae or growing any biofuel takes quite a lot of water. Are you working on systems that would take, for example, gray water or black water and use them in this whole cycle of energy production?
Yeah, one of the exciting things is algae doesn't really care about the type of water. So it can grow in wastewater. We think we could develop processing facilities adjacent to wastewater plants. We also know that it can grow in salty water, briny water. New Mexico has a lot of briny water under the surface. We're also very excited about the closed-loop systems, which minimizes the amount of water. In an open pit, you're obviously going to lose to evaporation. In a closed loop, you will lose some in the harvesting process, some water, but you're going to be able to conserve some, too. So, one of the advantages New Mexico has is threefold. Number one, we have lots of sunlight. It takes photosynthesis to produce algae and for algae to grow. We've got lots of land, and we've got lots of briny and wastewater and wastewater. We don't have lots of good potable water.
Right, but you wouldn't necessarily have to use any of that at all.
Correct.
So what kind of research and development are necessary for this to go into the kind of production and to be an actually used and effective source of fuel?
Well, James and I were just talking about that before. The biggest detriment right now is on the algae side is really still the extraction process. And James, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, we discovered the wonderful thing about algae is it has vegetable oil with inside the cell walls of each individual algae cell, critter, but they've also discovered that even though the algae grows incredibly fast, you harvest it multiple times throughout a season, is that the cell wall where the oil actually resides is an incredibly tough membrane, and cracking that, getting it to open up has been one of the stumbling blocks or the hindrances to getting production of volumes of oil into place. They've tried numerous things, the worst being hexane, which is a petroleum product, and it actually just basically destroys the cell wall and you can harvest the oil out of it. They've now moved on to the next one on the horizon that seems to hold the most glimmer of hope is an ultrasonic system of radio waves thrown at the algae cell itself and causing the cell walls to open. I liken it best to the illustration of back in the day when Aretha Franklin used to do the Memorex commercials and would break the wine glass.
Right.
That's exactly what that ultrasonic system is doing. And what it does, is it, because it's very low cost, because it takes very little amount of electricity to create the ultrasonic sounds, that harvests the oil. That seems to be our newest focus of how we're going to volume harvest oil.
It seems like also this is something where there's a great potential for decentralized production. Is that true?
Correct. I think a lot of opportunities are for distributed production. I mean, if in the algae area, you could have a variety of people growing algae and bringing it to a centralized local place for processing. Not everybody's going to have their own processing materials. So you could actually, it's almost like on-site generation or you know, community-based generation of fuel.
Now, have the numbers been run, like how many years it would take to get enough fuel to power all the cars in Santa Fe or all the heating oil needs of Santa Fe?
What volume are we looking for? What kind of numbers of I guess, estimations of
right.
what kind of volumes we'd... that I don't know. I think we are at such a point of our focusing on research of, okay, we've got algae growing. We can grow algae in gobs. Now if we can, the next step is that we need to be able to harvest it in huge volumes, and then we'll start answering that next equation of how much fuel, how much algae, how much harvesting do we need to do to start replacing all of the petroleum demands in cities, counties, states, and nationwide.
Now, can you make other things the way you can from petroleum, from algae? In other words, plastics and things like that?
Yes, you can. There's, of course, the primary thing that we use, the harvested algae cell membranes and the plant particles left over are primarily animal feeds. A lot of it can go into health foods. Spirulina, I'm sure a lot of our listeners already take spirulina from as a health supplement. So there's those areas that we can reuse the second co-product of the harvesting after we've taken out our oil. The other one that I've learned about recently was soybeans. They harvest a lot of soybeans for their oil content further back east, just because the conditions are better for that to grow out there. But there's a bunch of things that you can take the soybean mash and the soybean meal and the particulates and do the same thing, create plastics and other co-product goods like we do currently with petroleum products.
Now, one of the problems with the plastic made from petroleum products is that it lasts for hundreds of civilizations and it's having horrifying effects in the Pacific Ocean and so on. Would the plastics made from from plants be any more biodegradable than petroleum plastic?
Yes, yeah, considerably so, because the hydrocarbon chain from a plant is a little bit different structured, and it does break down much sooner. It's much more recyclable and much more biodegradable than the stuff that's going to last for, you know, the next 20 lifetimes floating around out in the oceans. That's one of the nice things about it, is that we are used to plastic shopping bags and plastic coffee mugs and plastic dashboards on our car, but if we can, and we can replace those with the hydrocarbons from soybeans or algae, they are much more recyclable and much less toxic to create from the first place.
So if a car dashboard lasts 100 years instead of 100,000 years, it's still going to outlast your use of that car.
Yes, it will.
I think it is important to run the numbers. I mean, one of the things that I was really struck by was I saw a calculation of the world's energy needs 20 to 30 years from now, given estimates of population growth and estimates of development in developing countries. And basically, to provide the world's electricity, you would, for example, have to build a nuclear power plant every other day for the next 45 years. They last 40, 50 years, and then you've got a gazillion, innumerable pounds of radioactive waste that nobody still knows what to do with. I think it's very important to look at, when you say this is one of many sources, to really look at what those numbers are of how not only New Mexico, but how the country, how the world is going to meet its energy needs.
Correct. You know, we're not going to get off of fossil fuels right away. We've got to come up with a game plan to mix things in, looking at renewable energies, whether it be solar, wind, biofuels. We've got to do a mixture of all those things, and you know, hopefully with research and technology, we'll even be able to improve on what we can produce from renewable sources and actually lessen our dependence on the need for electricity through more efficient appliances and cars and whatever we're doing. So it's got to be a combination of all those things. But, boy, we need to get started now, and, you know, that's why we have these programs.
I have to say, I just had somebody from Energy Works, which is a program of the city of Santa Fe that's free, come over to the house, put weather stripping around all the doors, give me some compact fluorescent light bulbs, a couple of other things, wrap the water heater in insulation, wrap the pipes. That's something that the city of Santa Fe is doing for free, and they're tracking the energy reduction in that over the next 10 years. These are very interesting programs as well.
Oh, correct. And, you know, actually the biggest bang for our buck right now is energy efficiency and weatherization. We're losing a lot of energy through heat loss or air conditioning loss, through use of inefficient light bulbs. We can really reduce our need for coal-fired electricity or any type of electricity just by improving those things. So that really should be the first step.
I want to give the number, by the way, for that program, which here in Santa Fe is 505-470-5892. So Randy Grissom is director of the Sustainable Technology Center. James Bingham is an instructor there. It's at the Santa Fe Community College. And they will be speaking tonight in a program called Burritos to Biofuels, sponsored by the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. That's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. For more information, people can call 505-603-7468. And it's at 6 o'clock at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe, and admission is free, and youth seating is a priority.
That's correct.
And it's just terrific that you guys are training our young people not
it's
only
important.
To think this way, but actually to do the work.
Mm-hmm. We're really excited about what we're doing at the college and about the programs, and we hope we see lots of young students tonight who get interested in science and technology.
Randy and James, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.